deliberately defying him. William hated nothing more than the feeling that people were laughing at him behind their hands. He had spent his life forcing people to respect him and his family, and this band of outlaws was undoing all his work. Especially galling for William was what people were saying behind his back, that it served him right. He had treated his tenants harshly, and now they were taking their revenge. He had brought this on himself. Such talk made him apoplectic with rage. The villagers of Cowford looked startled and fearful as William and his knights rode in. William scowled at the thin, apprehensive faces that looked out from the doorways and quickly disappeared again. These people had sent their priest to plead for them to be allowed to grind their own grain this year, saying that they could not afford to give the miller a tenth. William had been tempted to pull out the priest's tongue for insolence. The weather was cold, and there was ice around the rim of the mill pond. The water wheel was still, and the grindstone silent. A woman came out of the house beside the mill. William felt a spasm of desire when he looked at her. She was about 20 years old, with a pretty face and a cloud of dark curls. Despite the famine, she had big breasts and strong thighs. She had a saucy look when she first appeared, but the sight of William's knights wiped it off her face, and she ducked back inside. "She didn't fancy us," Walter said. "She must have seen Gervaise." It was an old joke, but they laughed anyway. They tied up their horses. It was not exactly the same group that William had gathered around him when the Civil War began. Walter was still with him, of course, and Ugly Gervaise and Hugh Axe. But Gilbert had died in the unexpectedly bloody battle with the quarrymen, and had been replaced by Guillaume. And Miles had lost an arm in a sword fight over dice at an alehouse in Norwich, and Louis had joined the group. They were not boys any more, but they talked and acted just the same, laughing and drinking, gambling and whoring. William had lost count of the alehouses they had wrecked, the Jews they had tormented, and the virgins they had deflowered. The miller came out. No doubt his sour expression was due to the perennial unpopularity of millers. His grouchy look was overlaid by anxiety. That was all right. William liked people to be anxious when he turned up. "I didn't know you had a daughter, Wulfric," William said, leering. "You've been hiding her from me." "That's Maggie, my wife," he said. "Cow shit, your wife's a raddled old crone, I remember her." "My May died last year, Lord, I've married again."
"You dirty old dog," William said, grinning. "This one must be 30 years younger than you."
25. "Enough of that. Where's my flower?"
"1 sack and 20.
"All here, Lord, if you please to come in." The way into the mill was through the house. William and the knights followed Wulfric into the single room. The miller's new young wife was kneeling in front of the fire, putting logs on. As she bent down, her tunic stretched tight across her rear. She had meaty haunches, William observed. A miller's wife was one of the last to go hungry in a famine, of course. William stopped, looking at her bottom. The knights grinned and the miller fidgeted. The girl looked around, realized they were staring at her, and stood up, covered in confusion. William winked at her and said, "Bring us some ale, Maggie. We're thirsty men." They went through a doorway to the mill. The flour was in sacks piled around the outside of the circular threshing floor. There was not much of it. Normally the stacks were higher than a man. "Is this all?" William said. "It was such a poor harvest, Lord," Wulfric said nervously. "Where's mine?" "Here, Lord." He pointed to a pile of 8 or 9 sacks.
"What?"
William felt his face flush.
"That's mine. I've got 2 wagons outside, and you offer me that?"
Wulfric's face became even more doleful.
"I'm sorry, Lord."
William counted them.
"It's only 9 sacks!
"That's all there is," Wulfric said. He was almost in tears.
"You see, mine next to yours. And it's the same."
"You lying dog," William said angrily.
"You've sold it."
"No, Lord," Wulfric insisted. "That's all there ever was." Maggie came to the doorway with 6 pottery tumblers of ale on a tray. She offered the tray to each of the knights. They took a mug each and drank thirstily. William ignored her. He was too wound up to drink. She stood waiting with the 1 remaining tumbler on the tray. "What's all this?" William said to Wulfric, pointing to the rest of the sacks, another 25 or 30 piled around the walls. A waiting collection, lord. You see the owner's mark on the sacks. It was true, each sack was marked with a letter or symbol. That might be a trick, of course, but there was no way William could establish the truth. He found it maddening, but it was not his way to accept this kind of situation. I don't believe you, he said. You've been robbing me. Wulfric was respectfully insistent, even though his voice was shaking.
I'm honest, lord.
There's never been an honest miller yet.
Lord!
Wulfric swallowed hard. Lord, I've never cheated you by so much as a grain of wheat. I'll bet you've been robbing me blind. Sweat ran down Wulfric's face despite the cold weather. He wiped his forehead with his sleeve. I'm ready to swear by Jesus and the saints.
Shut your mouth!
Wulfric was silent. William was letting himself get madder and madder, but he still had not decided what to do. He wanted to give Wulfric a bad scare, perhaps let Walter beat him up with the chainmail gloves, possibly take some or all of Wulfric's own flour. Then his eye fell on Maggie holding the tray with one cup of ale on it, her pretty face rigid with fear, her big young breasts swelling under the flowery tunic, and he thought of the perfect punishment for Wulfric. "Grab the wife," he said to Walter out of the corner of his mouth. To Wulfric he said, "I'm going to teach you a lesson." Maggie saw Walter moving toward her, but she was too late to escape. As she turned away, Walter grabbed her arm and pulled. The tray fell with a crash, and beer spilled on the floor as Maggie was jerked back. Walter twisted her arm behind her back and held her. She was shaking with fear. Wulfric said, "No, leave her, please," in a panicky voice. William gave a satisfied nod. Wulfric was going to see his young wife raped by several men, and he would be powerless to save her. Another time, he would make sure to have enough grain to satisfy his lord. William said, "Your wife's getting plump on bread made from stolen flour, Wulfric, while the rest of us are tightening our belts. Let's see just how fat she is, shall we?" He nodded to Walter. Walter grasped the neck of Maggie's tunic and pulled sharply down. The garment ripped and fell away. Underneath she wore a linen shirt that reached her knees. Her ample breasts rose and fell as she panted with fear. William stood in front of her. Walter twisted her arm harder, so that she arched her back in pain, and her breasts stuck out even more. William looked at Wulfric, then put his hands on her breasts and kneaded them. They were soft and heavy in his hands. Wulfric took a step forward and said, "You devil!" "Hold him," William snapped, and Louis grabbed the miller by both arms and held him still. William ripped off the girl's undershirt. His throat went dry as he stared at her voluptuous white body. Wulfric said, "No, please." William felt his desire rising. "Hold her down," he said. Maggie began to scream. William unbuckled his sword belt and dropped it on the floor as the knights took Maggie by the arms and legs. She had no hope of resisting 4 strong men, but all the same she kept writhing and screaming. William liked that. Her breasts jiggled as she moved, and her thighs opened and closed, alternately hiding and revealing her sex. The 4 knights pinned her down on the threshing floor. William knelt between her legs and lifted the skirt of his tunic. He looked up at her husband. Wulfric was distraught. He was staring in horror and mumbling pleas for mercy which could not be heard over the screaming. William savored the moment, the terrified woman, the knights holding her down, the husband looking on. Then Wulfric's eyes flickered away. William sensed danger. Everyone in the room was staring at him and the girl. The only thing that could conceivably divert Wulfric's attention was the possibility of rescue. William turned his head and looked toward the doorway. At that moment, something heavy and hard hit him on the head. He roared with pain and collapsed on top of the girl, his face banged against hers. Suddenly he could hear men shouting, lots of them. Out of the corner of his eye he saw Walter fall as if he too had been clubbed. The knights released their hold on Maggie. William looked at her face and read shock and relief there. She started to wriggle out from under him. He let her go and rolled away fast. The first thing he saw above him was a wild-looking man with a woodsman's axe, and he thought, "For God's sake, who is it? The father of the girl?" He saw Guillaume rise and turn, and in the next instant the axe came down hard on Guillaume's unprotected neck, its sharp blade cutting deep into his flesh. Guillaume fell on William, dead. His blood spurted all over William's tunic. William pushed the corpse off him. When he was able to look up again, he saw that the mill had been invaded by a crowd of ragged, wild-haired, unwashed men armed with clubs and axes. There were a lot of them. He realized he was in trouble. Had the villagers come to the rescue of Maggie? How dare they? There would be some hangings in this village before the end of the day. Enraged, he scrambled to his feet and reached for his sword. He did not have it. He had dropped his belt in order to rape the girl. Hugh Axe, Ugly Gervaise, and Louis were fighting fiercely against what looked like a huge mob of beggars. There were several dead peasants on the ground, but nevertheless the three knights were slowly being driven back across the threshing floor. William saw the naked Maggie still screaming, forcing her way frantically through the melee toward the door, and even in his confusion and fear he felt a spasm of regretful desire for that round, white backside. Then he saw that Wulfric was fighting hand to hand with some of the attackers. Why was the miller fighting the men who had rescued his wife? What the devil was going on? Bewildered, William looked around for his sword belt. It was lying on the floor almost at his feet. He picked it up and drew the sword, then took three steps back to stay clear of the fighting a moment longer. Looking past the fracas, he saw that most of the attackers were not fighting at all. They were picking up sacks of flour and running out with them. William began to understand. This was not a rescue operation by outraged villagers. This was a raiding party from outside. They were not interested in Maggie, and they had not known that William and his knights were inside the mill. All they wanted to do was rob the mill and steal William's flour. It was obvious who the raiders must be. Outlaws. He felt a surge of heat. This was his chance to strike back at the rabid pack who had been terrorizing the county and emptying his barns. His knights were overwhelmingly outnumbered. There were at least 20 attackers. William was astonished at the courage of the outlaws. Peasants would normally scatter like chickens before a band of knights, whether they outnumbered the knights by 2-1 or 10-1. But these people fought hard, and they were not discouraged when one of their number fell. They seemed ready to die if necessary. Perhaps that was because they were going to die anyway of starvation unless they could steal this flower. Louis was fighting two men at the same time when a third came up behind him and clubbed him with an iron-headed carpenter's hammer. Louis fell down and stayed down. The man dropped the hammer and picked up Louis's sword. Now there were two knights against 20 outlaws, but Walter was recovering from the blow to his head, and he now drew his sword and entered the melee. William raised his weapon and joined in. The four of them made a formidable fighting team. The outlaws were driven back, desperately parrying the flashing swords with their clubs and axes. William began to think their morale might crack, and they might flee in disorder. Then one of them shouted, "The rightful Earl!" It was some kind of rallying cry. Others took it up, and the outlaws fought more fiercely. The repeated cry, "The rightful Earl! The rightful Earl!" struck a chill into William's heart, even as he was fighting for his life. It meant that whoever was commanding this army of outlaws had set his sights on William's title. William fought harder, as if this skirmish might determine the future of the earldom. Only half the outlaws were actually fighting the knights, William realized. The rest were moving the flower. The combat settled into a steady exchange of thrust and parry, swipe and dodge. Like soldiers who know that the retreat must be sounded soon, the outlaws had begun to fight in a cautious, defensive style. Behind the fighting outlaws, the others were carrying the last of the flour sacks out of the mill. The outlaws began to retreat, backing through the doorway that led from the threshing floor into the house. William realized that, whatever happened now, the outlaws had got away with most of the flour. In no time at all, the whole county would know that they had stolen it from under his nose. He was going to be a laughingstock. The thought enraged him so much that he pressed a fierce attack on his opponent and stabbed the man through the heart with a classic thrust. Then an outlaw caught Hugh with a lucky jab and stabbed his right shoulder, putting him out of action. Now there were two outlaws in the doorway, holding off the three surviving knights. That in itself was humiliating enough, but then, with monumental arrogance, one of the outlaws waved the other away. The man disappeared, and the last outlaw stepped back a pace into the single room of the miller's house. Only one of the knights could stand in the doorway and fight the outlaw. William pushed forward, shouldering Walter and Gervaise aside. He wanted this man for himself. As their swords clashed, William realized immediately that this man was no dispossessed peasant. He was a hardened fighting man like William himself. For the first time he looked into the outlaw's face, and the shock was so great he almost dropped his sword. His opponent was Richard of Kingsbridge. Richard's face blazed with hatred. William could see the scar on his mutilated ear. The force of Richard's rancor frightened William more than his flashing sword. William had thought he had crushed Richard finally, but now Richard was back at the head of a ragamuffin army that had made a fool of William. Richard came at William hard, taking advantage of his momentary shock. William sidestepped a thrust, raised his sword, parried a slash, and stepped back. Richard pressed forward, but now William was partly shielded by the doorway, which restricted Richard's attack to stabbing strokes. Nevertheless, Richard drove William farther back, until William was on the threshing floor of the mill and Richard was in the doorway. Now, however, Walter and Gervaise went at Richard. Under pressure from the three of them, he retreated again. As soon as he backed through the doorway, Walter and Gervaise were squeezed out, and it was William against Richard. William realized that Richard was in a nasty position. As soon as he gained ground, he found himself fighting three men. When William tired, he could give place to Walter. It was almost impossible for Richard to hold all three of them off indefinitely. He was fighting a losing battle. Perhaps today would not end in humiliation for William after all. Perhaps he would kill his oldest enemy. Richard must have been thinking along the same lines, and presumably he had come to the same conclusion. However, there was no apparent loss of energy or determination. He looked at William with a savage grin that William found unnerving, and leaped forward with a long thrust. William dodged it and stumbled. Walter lunged forward to defend William from the coup de grace, but instead of coming on, Richard turned on his heel and fled. William stood up and Walter bumped into him while Gervaise tried to squeeze past them. It took a moment for the three to disentangle themselves, but in that moment Richard crossed the little room, slipped out, and banged the door shut. William went after him and threw the door open. The outlaws were making their escape, and, in a final humiliating stroke, they were riding off on the horses of William's knights. As William burst out of the house, he saw his own mount, a superb war horse that had cost him a king's ransom, with Richard in the saddle. The horse had obviously been untied and held ready. William was struck by the mortifying thought that this was the second time Richard had stolen his war horse. Richard kicked its sides and it reared up. It was not kind to strangers, but Richard was a good horseman and he stayed on. He soared on the reins and got the horse's head down. In that moment William darted forward and lunged at Richard with his sword, but the horse was bucking and William missed, sticking the point of his blade into the wood of the saddle. Then the horse took off, bolting down the village street after the other fleeing outlaws. William watched them go with murder in his heart. The rightful Earl, he thought, the rightful Earl. He turned around. Walter and Gervaise stood behind him. Hugh and Louis were wounded, he did not know how badly, and Guillaume was dead, his blood all over the front of William's tunic. William was completely humiliated. He could hardly hold up his head. Fortunately, the village was deserted. The peasants had fled, not waiting to see William's wrath. The miller and his wife had also vanished, of course. The outlaws had taken all the knight's horses, leaving only the two carts and their oxen. William looked at Walter. "Did you see who that was? That last one?" "Yes." Walter was in the habit of using as few words as possible when his master was in a rage. William said, "It was Richard, of Kingsbridge." Walter nodded. "And they called him the rightful Earl," William finished. Walter said nothing. William went back through the house and into the mill. Hugh was sitting up, his left hand pressed to his right shoulder. He looked pale. William said, "How does it feel?"
"This is nothing," Hugh said. "Who were those people?"
"Outlaws," William said shortly. He looked around. There were seven or eight outlaws lying dead or wounded on the floor. He spotted Louis flat on his back with his eyes open. At first he thought the man was dead, then Louis blinked. William said, "Louis?" Louis raised his head, but he looked confused. He had not yet recovered. William said, "Hugh, help Louis into one of the carts. Walter, put Guillaume's body into the other." He left them to it and went outside. None of the villagers would have horses, but the miller did, a dappled cob grazing the sparse grass on the riverbank. William found the miller's saddle and put it on the cob. A little while later he rode away from Cowford with Walter and Gervaise driving the ox-carts. His fury did not abate on the journey to Bishop Walleran's castle. In fact, as he brooded over what he had learned, he got angrier. It was bad enough that the outlaws had been able to defy him. It was worse that they were led by his old enemy Richard, and it was intolerable that they should call Richard the rightful Earl. If they were not put down decisively, very soon Richard would use them to launch a direct attack on William. It would be totally illegal for Richard to take over the earldom that way, of course, but William had a feeling that complaints of illegal attack coming from him might not get a sympathetic hearing. The fact that William had been ambushed, overcome by outlaws, and robbed, and that the whole county would shortly be laughing at his humiliation, was not the worst of his problems. Suddenly his hold over his earldom was seriously threatened. He had to kill Richard, of course. The question was how to find him. He brooded over the problem all the way to the castle, and by the time he arrived, he had figured out that Bishop Walleran probably held the key. They rode into Walleran's castle like a comic procession at a fair, the Earl on a dappled cob and his knights driving ox-carts. William roared peremptory orders at the bishop's men, sending one to fetch an infirmer for Hugh and Louis, and another to get a priest to pray for the soul of Guillaume. Gervaise and Walter went to the kitchen for beer, and William entered the keep and was admitted to Walleran's private quarters. William hated to have to ask Walleran for anything, but he needed Walleran's help in locating Richard. The bishop was reading an accounts roll, an endless list of numbers. He looked up and saw the rage on William's face. "What happened?" he said, in a tone of mild amusement that always infuriated William. William gritted his teeth. "I've discovered who is organizing and leading these damned outlaws." Walleran raised an eyebrow. "It's Richard of Kingsbridge." "Ah!" Walleran nodded, understanding. "Of course. It makes sense." "It makes danger," William said angrily. He hated it when Walleran was cool and reflective about things. "They call him the rightful Earl." He pointed a finger at Walleran. "You certainly don't want that family back in charge of this earldom. They hate you, and they're friends with Prior Philip, your old enemy."
"All right, calm down," Walleran said condescendingly. "You're quite right, I can't have Richard of Kingsbridge taking over the earldom."
William sat down. His body was beginning to ache. These days he felt the after-effects of a fight in a way he never used to. He had strained muscles, sore hands, and bruises where he had been struck or had fallen. "I'm only 37, he thought. "Is this when old age begins?" He said, "I have to kill Richard. Once he's gone, the outlaws will degenerate into a helpless rabble."
"I agree.
Killing him will be easy. The problem is finding him. But you can help me with that." Walleran rubbed his sharp nose with his thumb.
"I don't see how."
"Listen. If they're organized, they must be somewhere."
"I don't know what you mean. They're in the forest."
"You can't find outlaws in the forest normally, because they're scattered all over the place. Most of them don't spend two nights running in the same spot. They make a fire anywhere and sleep in trees. But if you want to organize such people, you have to gather them all together in one place. You have to have a permanent hideout.
So we have to discover the location of Richard's hideout."
"Exactly.
How do you propose to do that?"
"That's where you come in." Walleran looked skeptical. William said, "I bet half the people in Kingsbridge know where it is."
"But they won't tell us. Everyone in Kingsbridge hates you and me."
"Not everyone," said William. "Not quite." Sally thought Christmas was wonderful. The special Christmas food was mostly sweet, gingerbread dolls, frumenty, made with wheat and eggs and honey, perry, the sweet pear wine that made her giggly, and Christmas umbles, tripes boiled for hours, then baked in a sweet pie. There was less of it this year because of the famine, but Sally enjoyed it just as much. She liked decorating the house with holly and hanging up the kissing bush, although the kissing made her giggle even more than the pear wine. The first man across the threshold brought luck, as long as he was black-haired. Sally's father had to stay indoors all Christmas morning, for his red hair would bring people bad luck. She loved the nativity play in the church. She liked to see the monks dressed up as Eastern kings and angels and shepherds, and she laughed fit to bust when all the false idols fell down as the Holy Family arrived in Egypt. But best of all was the boy bishop. On the third day of Christmas, the monks dressed the youngest novice in bishop's robes, and everyone had to obey him. Most of the townspeople waited in the priory close for the boy bishop to come out. Inevitably, he would order the older and more dignified citizens to do menial tasks, such as fetching firewood and mucking out pigsties. He also put on exaggerated airs and graces and insulted those in authority. Last year he had made the sacrist pluck a chicken. The result was hilarious, for the sacrist had no idea what to do, and there were feathers everywhere. He emerged in great solemnity, a boy of about 12 years, with a mischievous grin, dressed in a purple silk robe and carrying a wooden crozier, and riding on the shoulders of 2 monks, with the rest of the monastery following. Everyone clapped and cheered. The first thing he did was to point to Prior Philip and say, "You, lad, get over to the stable and groom the donkey." Everyone roared with laughter. The old donkey was notoriously bad-tempered and was never brushed. Prior Philip said, "Yes, my lord bishop," with a good-natured grin, and went off to do his task. "Forward," the boy bishop commanded. The procession moved out of the priory close, with the townspeople following. Some people hid away and locked their doors for fear that they would be picked on to perform some unpleasant task, but then they missed the fun. All Sally's family had come. Her mother and father, her brother Tommy, Aunt Martha, and even Uncle Richard, who had returned home unexpectedly last night. The boy bishop led them first to the alehouse, as was traditional. There he demanded free beer for himself and all the novices. The brewer handed it over with good grace. Sally found herself sitting on a bench next to Brother Remigius, one of the older monks. He was a tall, unfriendly man, and she had never spoken to him before, but now he smiled at her and said, "It's nice that your Uncle Richard came home at Christmas." Sally said, "He gave me a wooden pussycat that he carved himself with his knife." "That's nice. Will he stay long, do you think?" Sally frowned. "I don't know. I expect he has to go back soon." "Yes, he lives in the forest now."
"Do you know where?"
"Yes, it's called Sally's Quarry. That's my name." She laughed.
"So it is," said Brother Remigius. "How interesting."
When they had drunk, the boy bishop said, "And now Andrew Sacrist and Brother Remigius will do the widow pole's washing." Sally squealed with laughter and clapped her hands. Widow Pole was a rotund red-faced woman who took in laundry. The fastidious monks would hate the job of washing the smelly undershirts and stockings that people changed every 6 months. The crowd left the alehouse and carried the boy bishop in procession to Pole's one-room house down by the quay. Paul had a laughing fit and turned even redder when they told her who was going to do her laundry. Andrew and Remigius carried a heavy basket of dirty clothing from the house to the riverbank. Andrew opened the basket, and Remigius, with an expression of utter distaste on his face, pulled out the first garment. A young woman called out saucily, "Careful with that one, Brother Remigius, it's my chemise." Remigius flushed, and everyone laughed. The 2 middle-aged monks put a brave face on it, and began to wash the clothes in the river water, with the townspeople calling advice and encouragement. Andrew was thoroughly fed up, Sally could see, but Remigius had a strangely contented look on his face. A huge iron ball hung by a chain from a wooden scaffold, like a hangman's noose dangling from a gallows. There was also a rope tied to the ball. This rope ran over a pulley on the upright post of the scaffold, and hung down to the ground, where 2 labourers held it. When the labourers hauled on the rope, the ball was pulled up and back until it touched the pulley, and the chain lay horizontally along the arm of the scaffold. Most of the population of Shiring was watching. The men let go of the rope. The iron ball dropped and swung, smashing into the wall of the church. There was a terrific thud, the wall shuddered, and William felt the impact in the ground beneath his feet. He thought how he would like to have Richard clamped to the wall in just the place where the ball would hit. He would be squashed like a fly. The laborers hauled on the rope again. William realized he was holding his breath as the iron ball stopped at the top of its travel. The men let go. The ball swung, and this time it tore a hole in the stone wall. The crowd applauded. It was an ingenious mechanism. William was happy to see work progressing on the site where he would build the new church, but he had more urgent matters on his mind today. He looked around for Bishop Walleran and spotted him standing with Alfred Builder. William approached them and drew the bishop aside. "Is the man here yet?"
"He may be," said Walleran. "Come to my house."
They crossed the market square. Walleran said, "Have you brought your troops?"
"Of course, 200 of them. They're waiting in the woods just outside town."
They went into the house. William smelled boiled ham and his mouth watered despite his urgent haste. Most people were being sparing with food at the moment, but with Walleran it seemed to be a matter of principle not to let the famine change his way of life. The bishop never ate much, but he liked everyone to know that he was far too rich and powerful to be affected by mere harvests. Walleran's place was a typical narrow-fronted townhouse with a hall at the front and a kitchen behind, and a yard at the back with a cesspit, a beehive, and a pigsty. William was relieved to see a monk waiting in the hall. Walleran said,
"Good day, Brother Remigius."
Remigius said, "Good day, my Lord Bishop. Good day, Lord William."
William looked eagerly at the monk. He was a nervous man with an arrogant face and prominent blue eyes. His face was vaguely familiar as one among tonsured heads at services in Kingsbridge. William had been hearing about him for years as Walleran's spy in Prior Philip's camp, but this was the first time he had spoken to the man. "Have you got some information for me?" he said.
"Possibly," Remigius replied.
Walleran threw off his fur-trimmed cloak and went to the fire to warm his hands. A servant brought hot elderberry wine in silver goblets. William took some and drank it, waiting impatiently for the servant to leave. Walleran sipped his wine and gave Remigius a hard look. As the servant went out, Walleran said to the monk,
"What excuse did you give for leaving the priory?"
"None," Remigius replied.
Walleran raised an eyebrow.
"I'm not going back," Remigius said defiantly.
"How so?"
Remigius took a deep breath.
"You're building a cathedral here."
"It's just a church."
"It's going to be very big. You're planning to make this the cathedral church, eventually."
Walleran hesitated, then said,
"Suppose for the sake of argument that you're right.
The cathedral will have to be run by a chapter, either of monks or of canons.
So,
I want to be prior."
That made sense, William thought. Walleran said tartly, "And you're so confident of getting the job that you've left Kingsbridge without Philip's permission and with no excuse." Remigius looked uncomfortable. William sympathized with him. Walleran, in a scornful mood, was enough to make anyone fidget.
"I hope I'm not overconfident," Remigius said.
"Presumably you can lead us to Richard?"
"Yes,"
William interrupted excitedly. "Good man, where is he?" Remigius remained silent and looked at Walleran. William said,
"Come on, Walleran, give him the job for God's sake."
Still, Walleran hesitated. William knew he hated to feel coerced. At last, Walleran said,
"All right, you shall be prior."
William said, "Now where's Richard?" Remigius continued to look at Walleran.
"From today."
"From today." Remigius now turned to William.
"A monastery isn't just a church and a dormitory. It needs lands, farms, churches paying tithes. Tell me where Richard is, and I'll give you 5 villages with their parish churches just to start you off," William said.
"The foundation will need a proper charter," Walleran said. "You shall have it, never fear."
William said, "Come on, man, I've got an army waiting outside town. Where's Richard's hideout?"
"It's a place called Sally's Quarry, just off the Winchester Road.
I know it.
William had to restrain himself from giving a whoop of triumph. It's a disused quarry. Nobody goes there any more.
I remember, said Walloran. It hasn't been worked for years. It's a good hideout. You wouldn't know it was there unless you actually walked into it.
But it's also a trap, William said with savage glee. The worked-out walls are sheer on three sides. Nobody will escape. I won't be taking any prisoners, either. His excitement rose as he pictured the scene. I'll slaughter them all. It will be like killing chickens in a henhouse. The two men of God were looking at him oddly. Feeling a little squeamish, Brother Remigius, William said scornfully. Does the thought of a massacre turn the stomach of my Lord Bishop? He was right both times, he could tell by their faces. They were great schemers, these religious men, but when it came to bloodshed, they still had to rely on men of action. I know you'll be praying for me, he said sarcastically, and he left. His horse was tied up outside, a black stallion that had replaced but did not equal the war horse Richard had stolen. He mounted and rode out of town. He suppressed his excitement and tried to think coolly about tactics. He wondered how many outlaws would be at Sally's quarry. They had mounted raids with more than 100 men at a time. There would be at least 200 of them, perhaps as many as 500. William's force could be outnumbered, so he would need to make the most of his advantages. One was surprise. Another was weaponry. Most of the outlaws had clubs, hammers, or at best axes, and none had armor. But the most important advantage was that William's men were on horseback. The outlaws had few horses, and it was not likely that many of them would be saddled ready just at the moment William attacked. To give himself a further edge, he decided to send a few bowmen up the sides of the hill to shoot down into the quarry for a few moments before the main assault. The most important thing was to prevent any of the outlaws from escaping, at least until he was sure that Richard was captured or dead. He decided to assign a handful of trustworthy men to hang back behind the main assault and sweep up any wily ones who tried to slip out. Walter was waiting with the knights and men-at-arms where William had left him a couple of hours earlier. They were eager and morale was high. They anticipated an easy victory. A short while later they were trotting along the Winchester Road. Walter rode alongside William, not speaking. One of Walter's greatest assets was his ability to remain silent. William found that most people talked to him constantly, even when there was nothing to say, probably out of nervousness. Walter respected William, but he was not nervous of him. They had been together too long. William felt a familiar mixture of eager anticipation and mortal fear. This was the one thing in the world he did well, and every time he did it he risked his life. But this raid was special. Today he had a chance to destroy the man who had been a thorn in his flesh for 15 years. Toward noon they stopped in a village large enough to have an alehouse. William bought the men bread and beer, and they watered the horses. Before moving on he briefed the men. A few miles farther on they turned off the Winchester Road. The path they took was barely visible, and William would not have noticed it had he not been looking for it. Once on it, he could follow it by observing the vegetation. There was a strip 4 or 5 yards wide with no mature trees. He sent the archers on ahead, and to give them a start, he slowed the rest of the men for a few moments. It was a clear January day, and the leafless trees hardly dimmed the cold sunlight. William had not been to the quarry for many years, and he was now not sure how far away it might be. However, once they were a mile or so from the road, he began to see signs that the track was in use. Trampled vegetation, broken saplings, and churned mud. He was glad to have confirmation of Remigius's report. He felt as taut as a bowstring. The signs became much more obvious. Heavily trampled grass, horse droppings, human refuse. This far into the forest the outlaws had made no attempt to conceal their presence. There was no longer any doubt. The outlaws were here. The battle was about to begin. The hideout must be very close. William strained his hearing. At any moment his bowmen would begin the attack, and there would be shouts and curses, screams of agony, and the neighing of terrified horses. The track led into a wide clearing, and William saw, a couple of 100 yards ahead, the entrance to Sally's quarry. There was no noise. Something was wrong. His bowmen were not shooting. William felt a shiver of apprehension. What had happened? Could his bowmen have been ambushed and silently dispatched by sentries? Not all of them, surely. But there was no time to ponder. He was almost on top of the outlaws. He spurred his horse into a gallop. His men followed suit, and they thundered toward the hideout. William's fear evaporated in the exhilaration of the charge. The way into the quarry was like a small, twisted ravine, and William could not see inside as he approached. Glancing up, he saw some of his archers standing on top of the bluff looking in. Why were they not shooting? He had a premonition of disaster, and he would have stopped and turned around, except that the charging horses could not now be stopped. With his sword in his right hand, holding the reins with his left, his shield hanging from his neck, he galloped into the disused quarry. There was nobody there. The anticlimax hit him like a blow. He was almost ready to burst into tears. All the signs had been there. He had felt so sure. Now frustration gripped his guts like a pain. As the horses slowed, he saw that this had been the outlaws' hideout not long ago. There were makeshift shelters of branches and reeds, the remains of cooking fires and a dunghill. A corner of the area had been fenced with a few sticks and used to corral the horses. Here and there William saw the litter of human occupation, chicken bones, empty sacks, a worn-out shoe, a broken pot. One of the fires appeared to be smoking. He had a sudden surge of hope. Perhaps they had only just left, and could still be caught. Then he saw a single figure squatting on the ground by the fire. He approached it. The figure stood up. It was a woman. "Well, well, William Hamley," she said. "Too late, as usual." "Insolent cow, I'll tear out your tongue for that," he said. "You won't touch me," she replied calmly. "I've cursed better men than you." She put her hand to her face in a three-fingered gesture like a witch. The knight shrank back, and William crossed himself protectively. The woman looked at him fearlessly with a pair of startling golden eyes. "Don't you know me, William?" she said. "You once tried to buy me for a pound." She laughed. "Lucky for you, that didn't succeed." William remembered those eyes. This was the widow of Tom Builder, the mother of Jack Jackson, the witch who lived in the forest. He was indeed glad he had not succeeded in buying her. He wanted to get away from her as fast as he could, but he had to question her first. "All right, witch," he said. "Was Richard of Kingsbridge here?"
"Until 2 days ago."
"And where did he go? Can you tell me that?"
"Oh, yes, I can," she said. "He and his outlaws have gone to fight for Henry."
"Henry?" William said. He had a dreadful feeling that he knew which Henry she meant. "The son of Maud?"
"That's right," she said.
William went cold. The energetic young Duke of Normandy might succeed where his mother had failed, and if Stephen was defeated now, William might fall with him.
"What's happened?" he said urgently. "What has Henry done?"
"He's crossed the water with 36 ships and landed at Wareham," the witch replied. "He's brought an army of 3,000 men, they say. We've been invaded." 3. Winchester was crowded, tense, and dangerous. Both armies were here. King Stephen's royal forces were garrisoned in the castle, and Duke Henry's rebels, including Richard and his outlaws, were camped outside the city walls on St. Giles's Hill, where the annual fair was held. The soldiers of both sides were banned from the town itself, but many of them defied the ban, and spent their evenings in the alehouses, cockpits, and brothels, where they got drunk and abused women and fought and killed one another over games of dice and nine men's morris. All the fight had gone out of Stephen in the summer when his elder son died. Now Stephen was in the royal castle and Duke Henry was staying at the bishop's palace, and peace talks were being conducted by their representatives, Archbishop Tybald of Canterbury speaking for the king, and the old power-broker Bishop Henry of Winchester for Duke Henry. Every morning Archbishop Tybald and Bishop Henry would confer at the bishop's palace. At noon, Duke Henry would walk through the streets of Winchester with his lieutenants, including Richard, in train, and go to the castle for dinner. The first time Aliena saw Duke Henry, she could not believe that this was the man who ruled an empire the size of England. He was only about 20 years old, with the tanned, freckled complexion of a peasant. He was dressed in a plain, dark tunic with no embroidery, and his reddish hair was cut short. He looked like the hard-working son of a prosperous yeoman. However, after a while she realized that he had some kind of aura of power. He was stocky and muscular, with broad shoulders and a large head, but the impression of crude physical strength was modified by keen, watchful grey eyes, and the people around him never got too close to him, but treated him with wary familiarity, as if they were afraid he might lash out at any moment. Aliena thought the dinners at the castle must have been unpleasantly tense with the leaders of opposing armies around the same table. She wondered how Richard could bear to sit down with Earl William. She would have taken the carving knife to William instead of to the venison. She herself saw William only from a distance and briefly. He looked anxious and bad-tempered, which was a good sign. While the earls and bishops and abbots met in the keep, the lesser nobility gathered in the castle courtyard, the knights and sheriffs, minor barons, justiciars and castellans, people who could not stay away from the capital city while their future and the future of the kingdom were being decided. Aliena met Prior Philip there most mornings. Every day there were a dozen different rumours. One day all the earls who supported Stephen were to be degraded, which would mean the end of William. Next day, all of them were to retain their positions, which would dash Richard's hopes. All Stephen's castles were to be pulled down, then all the rebels' castles, then everyone's castles, then none. One rumour said that every one of Henry's supporters would get a knighthood and 100 acres. Richard did not want that. He wanted the earldom. Richard had no idea which rumours were true, if any. Although he was one of Henry's trusted battlefield lieutenants, he was not consulted about the details of political negotiations. Philip, however, seemed to know what was going on. He would not say where he was getting his information, but Aliena recalled that he had a brother who had visited Kingsbridge now and again, and who had worked for Robert of Gloucester and the Empress Maud. Now, perhaps, he worked for Duke Henry. Philip reported that the negotiations were close to agreement. The deal was that Stephen would continue as king until he died, but Henry would be his successor. This made Aliena anxious. Stephen could live for another 10 years. What would happen in the interim? Stephen's earls would surely not be deposed while he continued to rule. So how would Henry's supporters, such as Richard, gain their rewards? Would they be expected to wait? Philip learned the answer late one afternoon, when they had all been in Winchester a week. He sent a novice messenger to bring Aliena and Richard to him. As they walked through the busy streets to the cathedral close, Richard was full of savage eagerness, but Aliena was possessed by trepidation. Philip was waiting for them in the graveyard, and they talked among the tombstones as the sun went down. "They've reached agreement," Philip said without preamble. "But it's a bit of a muddle." Aliena could not bear the tension. "Will Richard be Earl?" she said urgently. Philip rocked his hand from side to side in the gesture that meant maybe yes, maybe no. "It's complicated. They've made a compromise. Lands that have been taken away by usurpers shall be restored to the people who owned them in the time of old King Henry." "That's all I need," Richard said immediately. "My father was Earl in King Henry's time." "Shut up, Richard," Aliena snapped. She turned to Philip. "So what's the complication?" Philip said, "There's nothing in the agreement that says Stephen has to enforce it. There probably won't be any changes until he dies and Henry becomes king." Richard was crestfallen. "But that cancels it out." "Not quite," Philip said. "It means that you are the rightful earl. But I have to live as an outlaw until Stephen dies, while that animal William occupies my castle," Richard said angrily. "Not so loud," Philip protested as a priest walked by. "All this is still secret." Aliena was seething. "I don't accept this,"
she said. I'm not prepared to wait for Stephen to die. I've been waiting 17 years, and I've had enough.
Philip said, But what can you do?
Aliena addressed Richard. Most of the country acclaims you as the rightful Earl. Stephen and Henry have now acknowledged that you are the rightful Earl. You should seize the castle and rule as the rightful Earl.
I can't seize the castle. William is sure to have left it guarded.
You've got an army, haven't you? She said, becoming carried away by the force of her own anger and frustration. You've got the right to the castle, and you've got the power to take it.
Richard shook his head. In 15 years of civil war, do you know how many times I've seen a castle taken by frontal attack?
None.
As always, he seemed to gain authority and maturity as soon as he began to talk about military matters. It almost never happens. A town, sometimes, but not a castle. They may surrender after a siege, or be relieved by reinforcements, and I've seen them taken through cowardice or trickery or treachery, but not by main force.
Aliena was still not ready to accept this. It seemed to her a counsel of despair. She could not resign herself to more years of waiting and hoping. She said, So what would happen if you took your army to William's castle?
They would raise the drawbridge and close the gates before we could get inside. We would camp outside. Then William would come to the rescue with his army and attack our camp. But even if we beat him off, we still wouldn't have the castle. Castles are hard to attack and easy to defend. That's the point of them.
As he spoke, the seed of an idea was germinating in Aliena's agitated mind.
Cowardice, trickery, or treachery, she said.
What? You've seen castles taken by cowardice, trickery, or treachery.
Oh, yes.
Which did William use when he took the castle from us all those years ago?
Philip interrupted. Times were different. The country had had peace under the old King Henry for 35 years. William took your father by surprise.
Richard said, He used trickery. He got inside the castle surreptitiously with a few men before the alarm was raised. But Prior Philip is right. You couldn't get away with that nowadays. People are much more wary.
I could get in, Aliena said confidently, although as she spoke the words her heart raced with fear.
Of course you could. You're a woman, Richard said. But you couldn't do anything once you were inside. That's how come they'd let you in. You're harmless.
Don't be so damned arrogant, she flared. I've killed to protect you, and that's more than you've ever done for me, you ungrateful pig, so don't you dare call me harmless.
All right, you're not harmless, he said angrily. What would you do once inside the castle?
Aliena's anger evaporated.
What would I do, she thought fearfully. To hell with it. I've got at least as much courage and resourcefulness as that pig William.
What did William do?
Kept the drawbridge down and the gate open long enough for the main attacking force to get inside.
Then that's what I'll do, Aliena said with her heart in her mouth.
But how? Richard said skeptically.
Aliena remembered giving comfort to a 14-year-old girl who was frightened of a storm.
The Countess owes me a favor, she said, and she hates her husband.
They rode through the night, Aliena and Richard and 50 of his best men, and reached the vicinity of Earl's castle at dawn. They halted in the forest across the fields from the castle. Aliena dismounted, took off her cloak of Flanders wool and her soft leather boots, and put on a coarse peasant blanket and a pair of clogs. One of the men handed her a basket of fresh eggs packed in straw, which she slung over her arm. Richard looked her up and down and said,
Perfect. A peasant girl bringing produce for the castle kitchen.
Aliena swallowed hard. Yesterday she had been full of fire and boldness, but now that she was about to carry out her plan, she was scared.
Richard kissed her cheek. He said, When I hear the bell, I'll say the paternoster slowly once, then the advance party will start out. All you have to do is lull the guards into a false sense of security, so that 10 of my men can get across the fields and into the castle without causing alarm.
Aliena nodded.
Just make sure the main group doesn't break cover until the advance party is across the drawbridge. He smiled. I'll be leading the main group. Don't worry. Good luck. You too. She walked away. She emerged from the woodland and set out across the open fields toward the castle she had left on that awful day 16 years ago. Seeing the place again, she had a vivid, terrifying memory of that other morning, the air damp after the storm, and the two horses charging out of the gate across the rain-sodden fields, Richard on the war horse and she on the smaller mount, both mortally afraid. She had been denying what had happened, deliberately forgetting, chanting to herself in time with the horse's hoofbeats, "I can't remember, I can't remember, I can't, I can't, I can't." It had worked. For a long time afterward, she had been unable to recall the rape, remembering that something terrible had happened, but never recollecting the details. Not until she fell in love with Jack had it come back to her, and then the memory had so terrified her that she had been unable to respond to his love. Thank God he had been so patient. That was how she knew his love was strong, because he had put up with so much and still loved her. As she came closer to the castle, she conjured up some good memories to calm her nerves. She had lived here as a child with her father and Richard. They had been wealthy and secure. She had played on the castle ramparts with Richard, hung around in the kitchen and scrounged bits of sweet pastry, and sat beside her father at dinner in the great hall. "I didn't know I was happy," she thought. "I had no idea how fortunate I was to have nothing to be afraid of." "Those good times will begin again today," she said to herself, "if only I can do this right." She had confidently said, "The Countess owes me a favor, and she hates her husband." But as they rode through the night, she had thought of all the things that could go wrong. First, she might not get into the castle at all. Something might have happened to put the garrison on the alert. The guards might be suspicious. Or she might just be unlucky enough to come across an obstructive sentry. Second, when she was inside, she might not be able to persuade Elizabeth to betray her husband. It was a year and a half since Aliena had met Elizabeth in the storm. Women could get used to the most vicious men in time, and Elizabeth might be reconciled to her fate by now. Third, even if Elizabeth was willing, she might not have the authority or the nerve to do what Aliena wanted. She had been a frightened little girl last time they met, and it could be that the castle guard would refuse to obey her. Aliena felt unnaturally alert as she crossed the drawbridge. She could see and hear everything with abnormal clarity. The garrison was just waking up. A few bleary-eyed guards were lounging on the ramparts, yawning and coughing, and an old dog sat in the gateway scratching itself. She pulled her hood forward to hide her face, in case anyone should recognize her, and passed under the arch. There was a slovenly sentry on duty at the gatehouse, sitting on a bench, eating a huge hunk of bread. His clothing was disarrayed, and his sword belt was hanging from a hook at the back of the room. With her heart in her mouth, and a smile that belied her fear, Aliena showed him her basket of eggs. He waved her in with an impatient gesture. She had passed the first obstacle. Discipline was slack. It was understandable. This was a token force left behind while the best men went to war. All the excitement was elsewhere. Until today. So far, so good. Aliena crossed the lower courtyard with her nerves on edge. It was very odd to be a stranger walking into the place that had been her home, to be an infiltrator, where once she had had the right to go anywhere she pleased. She looked around, careful not to be too blatantly curious. Most of the wooden buildings had changed. The stables were bigger, the kitchen had been moved, and there was a new stone-built armory. The place seemed dirtier than it used to be. But the chapel was still there, the chapel where she and Richard had sat out that awful storm, shocked and numb and freezing cold. A handful of castle servants were beginning their morning chores. One or two men-at-arms moved about the compound. They looked menacing, but perhaps that was because she was aware that they would have killed her if they had known what she was going to do. If her plan worked, By tonight she would once again be mistress of this castle. The thought was thrilling but unreal, like a marvelous, impossible dream. She went into the kitchen. A boy was stoking the fire, and a young girl was slicing carrots. Aliena smiled brightly at them and said,